Views, information, or opinions contained in podcasts do not necessarily represent the opinions, standards, or policies of DRWF. The inclusion of details about products or services does not indicate DRWF endorsement of them. The aim of podcasts is to educate and inform, and we endeavour to ensure that the information provided in them is accurate. It's not a substitute for medical or health advice from a healthcare professional who's aware of the facts and circumstances of your individual situation. We always recommend that advice be sought from your GP or diabetes nurse before making any changes to medication or before using any products or services referenced by DRWF. Neither DRWF nor any of its employees or owners shall be held liable or responsible for the accuracy or completeness for any errors or omissions in podcasts or for any damage you may suffer as a result of failing to seek competent medical or health advice from a professional who is familiar with your situation.
Hello and welcome to the latest podcast in our series, Living with Diabetes, brought to you by Diabetes Research and Wellness Foundation. I'm Claire Levy, and in this two-part edition, I'm investigating the challenges of diagnosing type 1 diabetes in infants and young people following the tragic death of a girl just 2 years old who went into diabetes ketoacidosis, DKA, before the autoimmune condition was identified. These types of deaths are not uncommon among infants and young people in the UK because the symptoms are often combined with those from other conditions being experienced simultaneously. This has led to a call for higher professional awareness in primary care settings, together with a campaign for antibody screening to move from limited clinical studies to become routine in infants as young as 2 years old. Welcome to part one, in which we hear about the current status of type 1 in the UK, together with a tragic case study of the potential fatal consequences of misdiagnosis, especially in infants. I first spoke with Professor Parth Narendran, a reader in diabetes medicine at the University of Birmingham, and lead of the type 1 diabetes clinical service at the Queen Elizabeth Hospital in Birmingham.
Thanks for inviting me, Claire. So type 1 is a sort of chronic condition. It affects about 3 in 1,000 people in the UK. So with a population in the UK of 60 million, you'd expect about 180,000, 200,000 to live with type 1. If you look at the official estimates, though, it's much higher than that. And I don't know if that's because they're confusing type 2 insulin treated type 2 diabetes with type 1. So coding can be a little bit challenging. So it's somewhere between 200 and 500,000 in the UK living with type 1.
When are most people diagnosed, or is there an average age of diagnosis of type 1, or can it go across all ages?
It's across all ages, and we think of it as a children's disease. But what happens as you get into childhood is that it's drowned by this massive type 2 diabetes that comes on in the UK in the 40s. You know, there's a massive rise in type 2. So in children, over 90% of diabetes is type 1. And in adults, about 10% of diabetes is type 1, just to put that into context.
Absolutely. And those children grow up to be adults living with type 1. So if you are a parent and you have no knowledge, what are the things that parents then need to look out for if their children are showing signs of being poorly? What do they need to sort of think about that this might not just be a virus or another childhood illness?
The classic teaching is the four T's. So being more thirsty, being more tired, going to the toilet and passing water a lot, and losing weight, so thin. So those are the classic four T's. The real challenge here, Claire, is that often type 1 presents when there's something else going on. And people can mistake the illness just to the something else that's not going on and not recognize that there's type 1 just, you know, simmering under the background. And that's how these acute presentations are missed. So if we think about the biology, so what happens is that there's a gradual chipping away of the insulin producing cells. as the years go on, and it can take many years to lose these beta cells. And then it gets to a stage where essentially you're sitting on the brink, and the cells are just about able to make enough insulin to keep the glucose under control. And then something happens that unmasks that deficiency. And usually that something is, either an infection, sometimes it can be psychological stress, like an exam or a road traffic accident, the sort of psych things that cause us day-to-day psychological stress. And suddenly the remaining beta cells, which are just about holding the glucose, aren't they're not sufficient to do it. The glucose goes up, the people present to their physician, and the physician says, actually, it's the illness that's causing this, and they fail to recognize that the diabetes has been simmering in the background. So that, that's the thing, is be aware, be more open to the diagnosis of type 1 diabetes. It's a rare condition, as I said, but it's really, really important not to miss it.
So for a GP working in a practice, how often would they have a child come in those circumstances, and to recognise those symptoms? How many times are they diagnosing type 1, would you say?
So I would say once in a career. So a surgery, which may have a number of GPs, will only have a few type 1 people with type 1 on their books. So it's relatively rare. But this is the issue.
We'll hear more from Professor Narendran later in the podcast. In early May 2025, Lila Storey died in DKA from undiagnosed type 1 diabetes and other complications. She'd just celebrated her second birthday 3 weeks earlier. Her dad, John, came into the studio to explain what happened. I must warn you, this is an emotional and frank interview which details the tragic death of Lila.
She was fit, healthy, she could count well into her 20s. She knew all the nursery rhymes, Twinkle, Twinkle, Little Star being a favourite. She loved the song Walking in the Air. She used to love her dad flying her down the stairs while she was singing it. And she was just so fit and energetic and kind, caring, and sharing as well. Anyway, it was the last week of April turning into May, it was, because you had, I think it was 28th of April on the Monday. And on the Monday night, we noticed that she started getting a bit sniffly and a bit rosy-cheeked. So my wife checked her out and noticed that she was getting a little bit sore, and it looked like her back teeth were poking through, because they were due to come through at any moment anyway. And the temperature was a bit up, so we attributed it to all of that, So, as you do, a little bit of Calpol, get the temperature back down and everything. Tuesday morning, she gets up fit as a flea, eating, not excessively drinking or anything like that. Just carrying on as normal. She only just started nursery on the 22nd. So we knew at some point with her going to nursery as well, she's going to start picking things up, because she's mixing it with a lot of new kids and everything. But she was fine, came home absolutely fine. I fell asleep on the couch Tuesday night, like I'm very good at that, to be fair. And I walked up to bed early hours of Wednesday morning, and felt the bed was wet. And generally, the bed can be quite damp when I get in it, because in the middle of the night, Lila would come in for a what she affectionately called a bobo, just to drink her milk and just to get settled again. But I found out that Lila had unfortunately had an accident in the bed, and I thought it was diarrhea, but it wasn't actually. It was a large bowel movement, and what happened is, I think that night she'd started weeing a bit more. So gets up on the Wednesday morning, absolutely fine. Has some yogurt for her breakfast, a little bit of fruit, 'cause she loved her fruit. Goes to nursery as normal, comes home, and I was still working at the time, and Emma went out to walk with the dog, and she was sat next to me, and her nappy had burst on me, and she looked really tired. And I was saying to Emma, I said, something not right with her. I said, that can't just be teething, you know. And we thought, well, maybe it just is, because it was unusually warm around that time as well, which thought it might be making her groggy, coupled with the fact that she's at nursery now as well. It's tiring her out a bit. Gets up on the Thursday morning. Again, she was all right, you know. Thought, oh, brilliant. She goes to nursery, me and the wife are at work. My mum picked her up from nursery, and unbeknown to me at the time, the nursery teacher actually said to my mother that she's not been her usual self. She's stopped talking altogether. And when my mum brought her round through the door at about 3:30 after picking our Jack up from nursery, I just took one look at her and I was a bit scared, to be honest. She looked like she'd lost weight. Her eyes looked a bit sunken. And I just immediately said to Emma, I said, there's something wrong with her. And for some reason, I just went, because normally, as the father, bumped your head or you trapped your finger or anything like that, but like, get her to hospital, get him to hospital. But I was really calm and collected about it. And I said, there's something wrong with her. You need to get her to the doctors. And I said, doctors, for some reason. So Emma tries ringing the doctors. Emma explained what's been going on. She's having more wet nappies. She's not been her usual self. She's started drinking more. And she's tired. She's not been a jolly self. She stopped talking as well, you know. Anyway, they said, oh, you're going to need to come back in the morning. You know, ring up at 8 o'clock in the morning, see if we can get a same-day appointment. So Emma goes to work, but on the way to work, she rings the doctors. We kept her off nursery, but my mum came to collect her, and then Emma went to go see her at my mum's. Now, during that time, me and Lila, we always had like a golden 10 minutes. I used to start work a little bit earlier so that I could have that 10 minutes just to, because she always used to sit on my knee while mum took Jack to the car. And she was sick on me, and I'm like, well, she's not normally a sicky girl, you know, that's not normal. Anyway, my mum took her home. She was sick in the bath. And then Emma managed to get an appointment for 20 to 11 in the morning. They called her through at 10 to 11, and as they called her through, she was sick in the reception area. Called her through. She was falling asleep in the appointment. Checked her sats, checked her breathing, checked her pulse. She said her pulse is a bit high, but that might be normal if she's got a virus. Took a look in her throat, checked other parts of her, checked her skin for meningitis, and then said, I'll just take another look in your throat. And she saw white spots on her throat. And she said, well, right, this is what it is. She's got tonsillitis. Get some amoxicillin, you know, the banana stuff, and she should pick up. If she doesn't pick up in the next 24 hours, then call 111 or take her to Children's A&E. So Emma gives me a call while I'm out doing my job. She says, oh, it's tonsillitis. And we thought, oh, well, that's a relief. That's probably why she's stopped talking, because she's in pain with her throat. And sadly, what that did to us was that changed our perceptions of care for Lila on that occasion. We thought she'd gone non-verbal at first. But she, with her being so bright, it would have been quite strange for her to go non-verbal. So we thought, oh, well, now we know it's tonsillitis, then we can, you know, we know what to do. I took her, we made the decision together, because Emma, with her having lupus, she can get quite tired and she physically exhausted. So what she always used to do was that she always used to go to bed at 6 o'clock, but she'd generally put Lila to bed with her first, have a bottle, settle her down. She'd put Lila to bed, she'd go to bed. And then when I heard her crying in the night, I'd come to her again. I want my mummy. Okay, bring it to mummy. But we made a decision between us that Lila would go to bed with mummy at about 5:30, and I would stay downstairs and sleep downstairs so that Lila had that comfort and reassurance. She had the space and room to manoeuvre. As I started carrying her up the stairs at 5:30, she started calling out Mummy, and we was like, brilliant. You know, that's brilliant. The drugs are working, basically. That's what we thought. Sorry.
Don't apologise.
And I laid her down. Walked out the room. I was like, what am I doing? Walked back in, gave her a kiss and went, night, night, darling, I love you. And that were my last words to her. Went downstairs to Jack and said, no riving about tonight, Jack. You've got to be good. Lila's a bit poorly at the moment, but it's okay. The doctor's seen her. She's given her some medicine and she'll be okay and she'll be well enough for when we go on holiday next Thursday. And he's like, okay. Jack fell asleep about 7:30. I carry him to bed at 8:00. I check on Emma and Lila. Emma said, yep. She's breathing, she's temperate, but she's making, now and again, she makes a little ah noise. Now, we again thought, brilliant. She's articulating, the throat's hurting a little bit. That was the last time I went upstairs. Emma woke up about 10:00, changed her nappy. She last checked on her between 1:30 and 2 a.m. I woke up about 3:45 in the morning. For some reason, I thought, well, I'll just watch 30 minutes television. I went to bed and I found Lila, lifeless and colourless. I knew at that point she'd already gone. And I think she passed away only 30 minutes after Emma last checked on her. Paramedics were wonderful. They did all they could. Took her to the hospital, blue lighted her. It was, honestly, it was like something off the television. They worked on her as hard as they could. They even ran tests on her while in rhesus. Unfortunately, her official time of death was 5:25 a.m. But we think it was about 2:30. And the cause of death was undiagnosed type 1 diabetes, diabetic ketoacidosis, a gastrointestinal bleed, and COVID-19. When I had the discussion with consultant paediatrician, I said, how on earth, when we were told that she had tonsillitis and 16 hours later, she's dead? What? How on earth could a doctor just think it was tonsillitis when here we are? And we, you know, the police were wonderful with us while we were there, but it was like, you're not under suspicion, but you're under suspicion, you know. But even when I was giving interviews to the police, even they were crying and they couldn't believe how a child of 2 years old, she'd only been 2-3 weeks, how someone so bright and vibrant had just rapidly declined like that, when all it would have taken would have been a simple dip test of a urine or off a nappy, or, you know, the finger prick. So that's basically what happened to Lila.
It's a very sad story, which regrettably is not uncommon, as Professor Narendran confirmed.
This misdiagnosis doesn't appear to be changing. So for many, many years, we've seen misdiagnosis, sometimes, unfortunately, with the tragic consequences. And this is not changing. It's not changing in England or Wales or in other countries. So when education programs have been put in to educate our primary care colleagues, sometimes there is a dip in the acute presentations, but it doesn't last for long. And some education programs haven't shown a difference. So we need something different. We need absolutely something different so that these critical diagnoses are not missed.
And so can then you just describe what happens when the patient worsens and goes into DKA, diabetes ketoacidosis? What is happening there?
So what's happening there is So there's so few beta cells making insulin. So the insulin levels are falling. So insulin is a hormone that's a builder-upper. It's an anabolic hormone. So as the insulin levels are falling, people are losing weight. And also insulin is a builder-upper for fat tissue as well as protein as well. So the protein levels, mass is falling, fat is being broken down. And one of the components of fat is a slightly acidic molecule. So that causes the acid levels to rise as fat is being broken down. And acid's not good for us, you know, it makes us unwell, it prevents the body working well. So what happens as the insulin levels fall is that the glucose levels go up. So that's the diabetes. The ketone bodies, the fat, the acidic bit of the fat go up. That's the K, the ketosis, and then the acidosis, diabetic ketoacidosis. So that's what happens. And it's an absolute emergency. So it needs to be treated immediately with insulin treatment and with fluids. And with electrolytes as well. And this is an emergency diagnosis. Sometimes patients end up in ITU with these conditions.
As a result of his experience, John Storey is determined to discover how such a tragic misdiagnosis could happen and to explore what can be done to prevent the same fate affecting more children and their families.
I do apologise if I start crying, but...
Don't.
When I held her in my arms, you know, afterwards, I said, look, Daddy's going to tell you all the daddy stuff you need to hear. But I need to tell you this first. I will fight with every fibre of my being to ensure we find out why this has happened to you and that I'm going to make sure that it's never going to happen to another child again. But, I we said our goodbyes then. We visited her in the mortuary as well. But I just thought this isn't right. This is not right at all. What's happened here? I need to fight for her. And I think Lila, because she's like that. She was the perfect blend of a father and a mother. She had her kind, compassionate, and caring side, but she had she had her sassiness and her I don't give a SH1T from a father, you know. She always stood her ground. She was very independent, but she would want me in her legacy to fight for her, and to make sure that no other child goes through the pain that she's been through, because I've found out since that diabetes is the silent killer. Type 1 diabetes is the silent killer. And people need to get it in their heads, Claire, right? I hope this goes out to the world. People need to get it into their heads. Type 1 diabetes isn't caused by kids eating too many sweets or kids getting fat, so to speak, or not exercising enough or anything like that, or running in the family. It's an autoimmune condition. And if you aren't seen to and treated for that as soon as possible, you're at death's door. And I am fed up of people saying as well that it's rare. It's rare. So I'm all right, Jack. One in 250 children have been diagnosed with it. Yeah? You fancy playing with that deck of cards? I wouldn't. I'd take any chances. Sadly, I was ignorant to things like that as well in the past. I'm not ignorant in the sense of seeing some of the comments that's been going around on the Barbie doll page and things like that, you know, for the T1D Barbie. What I mean is because I had no understanding of type 1 at all, it never entered my mind about what the four T's are. And obviously, for those not listening, that's tiredness, thinning, what's the other two? Thirst and toileting.
Toileting.
Yeah, so them four T's. But in young toddlers, I mean, I have launched a YouTube video as well, but in young toddlers, it's also critical. If they're weeing the nappies a lot more and they're going through more nappies, it sounds disgusting, but sniff their nappies, because if they smell sweet like sugar puffs when they haven't been eating sugar puffs, or popcorn or anything like that, toffee popcorn, that's a sign.
Because the sugar is remaining in the bloodstream and cannot be used by the body.
And they're desperately trying to release them dangerous ketones. So I've been saying, look, if they're experiencing that and they are drinking more, and if they're asking for water, Lyle, this is Emma said to the doctor, she's asking for water. What 2-year-old asks for water? Just get them to hospital. Get them to hospital, because I really do feel that, and we'll get onto that in a minute, but I really do feel that not only are the general public not educated enough around the subject and dangers of type 1 diabetes, but I also feel that primary care workers, like your general practitioners, are not educated enough around the subject.
You're listening to Living with Diabetes, the DIWF podcast, and our investigation into the challenges of diagnosing type 1 in young people, especially infants. You can find helpful guidance on this and other aspects of diabetes, together with the details on how to support the charity, fundraising events, news and information on our website at drwf.org.uk. This is Claire Levy from Diabetes Research and Wellness Foundation. Our thanks to Professor Narendran and John Story for talking to us, and also to you for listening. Coming up in part two, we'll hear about a study which could lead to a national screening programme and the campaign to introduce Lila's Law to reinforce guidance on testing for diabetes when infants present with classic symptoms.
The story of Lila is absolutely tragic, and I've come across these so many times, and they unfortunately continue. It's so important to educate our primary care colleagues and support them with picking these conditions up early.
Politicians are getting this wrong. The ELSA study is not a screening programme, a universal screening programme at all. It's a voluntary clinical study for those potentially at risk of type 1 diabetes.
We can screen people who feel perfectly well, but pick up this immune process many, many years before. And that gives you time. It reduces the risk of DK significantly. And a recent Italian study showed that the DK rates, you know, which classically are about 20% in most countries, it went down to zero because people knew this was coming.
People just do not understand how dangerous DK is. I have had over 160 emails so far. Of them 160 emails, I've had just 2 people who have been diagnosed at the point of access with the GP. The rest have gone into DKA, critical condition, where they have seen their child strapped to a table, desperately trying to find somewhere to put a cannula in because they're that dehydrated they cannot find a vein. And they go through days and days and days of thinking their child is going to die. A lot of them people have come out the other side. Lila is not so lucky, and we are not so lucky because, you know, we love her so much.
Living with Diabetes is a Blue Aurora media production for DRWF. Copyright 2025, Diabetes Research and Wellness Foundation. All rights reserved.